Welcome to Conversations with Alan Wolper, a half-hour autobiography featuring unique personalities whose lives and ideas are on the cutting edge. Alan Wolper is an award-winning journalist and a professor at Rutgers University, Newark. And now, here's Conversations with Alan Wolper.
Julio Medina was a major drug dealer in New York, making millions of dollars selling cocaine, much of which was smuggled into the United States from South America. Eventually, his drug dealing caught up with him, and he wound up serving 12 years in prison. But when he was released from Sing Sing, one of the most violent institutions in America, he'd straightened himself out and was ready to leave his drug dealing behind him. Today, he's executive director of an East Harlem organization that tries to give a second chance to former inmates who want or need a job. In 2004, he was honored by President George Bush for his work. Julio, welcome to the program. That's quite a story. Tell us about your journey.
Sure. Thank you, Alan, for having me on the show. First of all, it's a wonderful opportunity to be here and to talk about transformation and what that means, kind of in prison. Sometimes we just get the story of chapter one, which was, the wrong stuff that I did, and as opposed to chapter two, which is now talks about what happened in prison, some of the changes that took place in prison.
We want every chapter.
I want every chapter. I'll give you every chapter. But, all those things you say as the introduction are true. But I always say, that it doesn't define, the worst moment of my life doesn't define who I am.
But I think people will tend to understand you better if they knew what it was like growing up in the South Bronx. So why don't you tell us what that was like? How about 14 years old, your first drug sale?
14 years old, first drug sale.
About to go to Cardinal Hayes High School?
About to go to Cardinal Hayes High School.
You took the test, you passed
Actually,
it?
I get into Cardinal Hayes High School, so I was always a smart guy. I just used it for the wrong, sometimes for the wrong reasons, but I was always a smart guy, so I did pass the test. I got into Cardinal Hayes High School. I got arrested. I got arrested for a loaded firearm, and I was sentenced to 5 years probation at that time. I was still in Hayes. I was still, they kind of left me there, and I completed probation and, without incident. And
passing Regents?
Passing Regents. And in order to get through, you got to pass Regents. That's right. I don't want to – I think there was opportunity. The problem was I didn't see it in the midst of poverty. I didn't see it in the midst of the South Bronx. I didn't see it in people's lives displayed daily. I didn't see success. And by that success, I didn't at that time in my life, we're very impressionable, and not as an excuse, but the person who impressed me was the drug dealer, was the person who had everything, who didn't have to go to work, who didn't, kind of things came very, very easy. I didn't know what was happening behind the scenes, that you just see kind of all the materialism, and you see the money, and you see the woman, and you see the cars, and you say, wow, whatever that is, I want to do that, right?
You don't see doctors and lawyers.
But that old adage is true, right? You don't see that. You don't see that, Alan. You don't see that coming by, being successful, saying, hey, guys, you can do this too. And I think that's important. Role modeling is very important.
You had Tiny Archibald, though.
We had Tiny Archibald way back. I could never play basketball, so.
We should tell everybody Tiny Archibald is one of the great high school players in the Bronx. He went on to play for the Boston Celtics, if I remember.
That's right. That's right. I think one time led in both assists and points one of those seasons.
He got out and you didn't.
He got out. He could play ball, and he got out. And I think, sports is always a venue, but I think there's other venues as well for people, not only to kind of get out, but actually come back once they are successful and try to do something in those same communities that at one point in their lives they may have either grown up in or helped to destroy.
Drugs helps the family, though, doesn't it, when you sell it? They can eat?
Looking back now, from the position that I was in then, you say, well, yeah, it helped one individual family.
And it helped yours.
And I was that individual family. But the lives that it the families that it destroyed for my individual family, I don't think it was worth it. I can say that now. I didn't see that back then.
Why not?
You know, I was talking to somebody, and this was recent. You know, we were talking about the old days. And we're talking about food stamps, you know, when you actually got food stamps in the book and paper money. And, you know, the sad reality used to be, I remember on the 1st and the 15th, I would get, you know, $10,000 in food stamps for people who sold their food stamps for drugs. And, you know, when you go now and you look at it, that could be some of the saddest stuff that I've ever engaged in, when you're taking someone's, you know, food off the table and they're actually buying, purchasing. Back then with food stamps was one of the lowest moments, at least I believe in my life. We were talking about this recently. So again, when you're there, when you're 15, 16, 17, 19, you know, you don't see it, right? You're kind of just blind to the fact that, wow, I'm making money and I'm rich and my family can eat and that's fine. But you don't see the destruction that it's causing around you.
Just as sad as the fact that the authorities don't see it either.
Exactly.
You were invisible.
Yeah, for a time, yeah. For a time I was.
But you went to school. Why'd you go to Cardinal Hayes if you were going to be a drug dealer? I don't understand that. I mean, people wanted to get in that school. You passed the test.
Yeah, there was a... So my older brother went to Cardinal Hayes as well. It was a kind of tradition in our family, you know. So we grew up in a Catholic household in the Bronx. Mother made sure we went to school, so she didn't want to, you know. So that was kind of the track we went on. We went to Catholic grammar school.
St. Jerome's,
and Catholic high school. So that was the track that we were supposed to be on. And all it was allowing moms to see, hey, look, we're in here and we're doing well, and we're passing our classes. And I think that's what it came down to.
But what happens? All of a sudden, you are selling. You're 14 years old. You're selling first marijuana.
It starts with weed, and then you elevate it right to coke and heroin, and you know.
And you begin to have friends, and those friends begin to see you more than just the dealer.
Exactly. Yeah.
And how'd that happen?
You know, you end up well. So I'm a charismatic guy anyway, right? So
yeah.
So you're here. That's why I'm here. And unfortunately back then, that charisma led people in a lot of people in the wrong direction. That charisma was, hey guys, we can kind of take over the planet, you know.
How many of there were you?
Well, who eventually got arrested was 10 of us, maybe another 10 got away. So it probably was about 20 total.
That's a nice size group.
Oh no, but it's again, I think Alan is it back then it is, and back then, you know, you do these things. You know, we were back then, we were prosecuted by the organized crime task force of the Northern District, and
that means you had accomplished a lot of crime and. They got to know who you were and why would they pick on you? I mean, were you producing and distributing
the,
that much?
Yeah,
stuff?
They picked on the right guy. I wasn't innocent. I'm glad I could sit here and tell you about the story because I could have ended up doing much, much more time. So I'm glad I'm here. I'm glad I'm talking about the story. I'm glad it was.
And you're glad you're in one piece.
And I'm glad I'm in one piece. That's right. So, you know, in this lifestyle, a lot of people don't come back to tell this story. So I'm glad I'm here to do that.
But your early life, your father, you didn't know your father very well. You see him two or three times. At one point, he tried to kill your mother, if I recall.
You know, I didn't, it was crazy. So my mother recently told me this. Well, my mother has dementia now, so this must have been about maybe 5-6 years ago. So I remember, these are the images I have of my quote-unquote biological father, right? So the image was, I must have been 10, 11 years old. My mother sends me out there, along with my sister. And we go out to Puerto Rico, and I remember going in a car with him. And all I remember is him going into the glove compartment and pulling out this long gun. And then we walk into this mall, but there's people around him. I don't see it, you know, then. I think I see it now. I believe they were probably his bodyguards or something, and I'm not sure what life he was into back then. But they had a big farm in Puerto Rico, and they sold cows. You know, well, they supplied the town with milk from the farm. But I saw him 2-3 times in my younger years. I seen him, I don't know, maybe 6-7 years ago. And I tell you, Alan, it's funny because I guess maybe some of us do realize the significance of a father figure. Maybe some of us don't. I don't know. But I've gone all my life with, you know, maybe a stepdad, you know. So, you know, you kind of just go along with it. Like, all right, this is fine. I don't need a quote-unquote father.
A biological father,
you know.
Who's not here.
And it's amazing because I've seen him now. So I'm an adult now, you know. I see him, like, again, 7 years ago or something. And he comes, he's like, hey, how you doing? He's talking to me in Spanish, it's in Puerto Rico. I'm like, hey, how you doing, you know? And there's this awkward silence. He stays for the best part of 10 minutes. He says, okay, wow, great seeing you, man. And he leaves. And, you know, I was devastated. I didn't realize.
You didn't think you thought he'd hang around a while?
Or but just... I didn't know what I would think. I never saw him, so I didn't know what to think. But I realized how much of that I never had and that I probably wanted. How much that I wanted to be able to say I have a dad. And I wonder how many people grow up this way. And even at an adult age, I was hurt. I mean, he left and I kind of like wiped a tear from my eye. You know, don't let nobody see. I was like, what the hell just happened here? I thought I didn't need a dad. I've been over this stuff. I don't know. I guess the callousness of him coming and leaving and maybe it just was the awkwardness of not knowing what to say to somebody he's never seen. It took me aback. It took me aback and made me realize, wow, I wonder what we can do if good fathers were in people's lives, you know, and maybe steering those lives in the right direction. Because it felt as though I was looking for some type of validation. Some type, wow, that's cool though. Hey, man, you're doing good at Exodus? Or he knew nothing. He knew nothing about my life.
Well, you'll be able to pass that on to your two children.
There you go.
And we'll talk about them in a while.
Okay.
And I want to tell everybody exactly who I'm talking to. You're listening to Conversations with Alan Walper on WBGO 88.3 FM and WBGO.org. Our guest is Julio Medina, Executive Director of Exodus Transitional Community in East Harlem in New York City, which helped thousands of former incarcerated men and women transition back to society. But first you have to get through places like Sing Sing, Comstock. You were in 4 prisons, right?
Yep.
Comstock was first.
Comstock, Clinton, Easton, and Sing Sing.
What was that like? Tell us about it. I think people just don't know what someone has to go through in order to get to position to be rehab.
Sure.
And maybe they don't want to.
So let's begin with reception. And reception is this area where you go to where...
That was Comstock.
That was downstate. That was a 5th
downstate.
Prison.
Downstate,
yeah. So downstate was a prison where you go, you're isolated most of the day, but basically you walk in there. You're given some lice to put over your body. Your head is shaved bald. I still had hair back then.
Still shaved.
Yeah. and you're hosed. They actually hose you. They actually hose you to get, you know, whatever offer you. They give you some prison beige garbs. You're assigned a number, I believe. I remember, you know. And then you go into and you lock into the cell and they run a battery of tests from HIV to a bunch of stuff over a 3-week period. And then after that 3-week period, they ship you to whatever facility you're going to be at. And after that 3-week period, I was shipped to Comstock. So that's in Great Meadow, New York. And again, so this is the work that I do. So these stories come up often, you know, when people come home, what prison were you in? So we were talking about Comstock. I was telling people this was probably the filthiest prison I have ever been in my life.
Like, still, what do you think?
I mean, I doubt much has changed, but who knows? You know,
everybody's talking about second chances now.
Maybe it's better.
Yeah.
There you go. So maybe it's part of those second chances they did something. But this place was so rat infested. I mean, just all you we were talking about. That's why this is so fresh on my mind. You actually had to hang whatever food you had on the ceiling. And then you see the rats trying to jump up there to try to get it, you know, while you're in your cell, by the way. You know, so I'm talking about they'll run across your bed or whatever.
Like, running across your back.
Yeah. If you're in the bed, yeah, they'll run right across you. Like, horrible, horrible. Like, put it this way. So I'm the guy who's afraid of everything, right? I'm afraid of a roach. Yeah. So I'm this big, tough guy outside. But, you know, you put an animal next to me and, you know, some type of rodent, and it's another story. So you could imagine me on the top bunk. Oh, help. I'll never do anything again. Just let me out of here. That's all they had to do, was that type of rat torture treatment or something. They would never have to worry about it. At least me, or anyone who's afraid of rats, you know, committing a crime. But horrendous conditions. And again, violent. A violent prison that the correction officers kind of own. And they make that very clear that they own it. I mean, once you're getting off the bus, they wanted us to line up. I remember lining up too far away from the guy in front of me because, you know, you want to give somebody space. And I remember the CO just hit me in the back with his stick. Move up. Like, okay. But it's that type of violence. They clearly are in control. Like in most prisons, they want to make that known, that they are in control of the situation.
And you have to be able to survive. And you had to survive amidst one knife fight after another.
Basically, yeah. I think you know, again, prisons are violent. Prisons are not, you know.
You got to protect yourself.
But you got to protect yourself. And people don't, you know. It's not one of those places where, you know, you watch on reality television. You know, a lot of the men respect themselves. A lot of men respect each other. There are those wars against gangs. There are those fights that break out over drugs or whatever else. But there are also, you know, opportunities for people to talk to each other and grow, actually, and not kill each other. But, you know, we have those violent pockets as throughout the country. You know, New York State represents a part of that where it is violent. It is violent when you bring men that are, you know, full of testosterone, you know.
I was thinking about some of the things you wrote about in the first-person piece. And you mentioned all the blood around you and mm-hmm. how you had to deal with that. And finally, you decided, too much blood.
You know, again, I wasn't, I'm no tough guy. I wasn't, you know. But you watch this blood, you know. There has to come a point where you wake up and you realize, what are we doing? Why are we sitting here killing each other? And that point happened, I guess, in Sing Sing. But prior to that, you know, there was those times when I really tried to move away from it. I didn't want the blood on me because, again, you're taken to a sergeant's office and they do an investigation and you got to get locked up. So most of the time, you don't want to be in a situation like that. So if you know someone is going to get stabbed, you move away from the blood. And that's what I did the majority of the time until that one moment where I can no longer move, Alan, where I had to stop.
And you were involved in knife fights yourself.
I was involved in knife fights. Yes, I was. And you know, you survive in prison, but then you get past that point, and I think you grow up, you mature, and you realize that it's not about the violence. You start realizing other things.
And 5 years into it, suddenly, you notice that you can take a course. Now I'm a little confused by this. Did you graduate from Cardinal Hayes?
I graduated from Cardinal Hayes.
Then you went to the State University in Albany?
Yes, I did.
Did you graduate from there?
Close.
You were close?
Close.
You were the college pharmacist,
yeah,
according.
Yeah, you got it.
People probably had more money than the people in your neighborhood,
right? I was the guy. Believe it or not, we made more money yet in the college.
So the tuition was coming back to
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, it was.
And then did you finish your college?
Yeah,
in prison?
In prison, yeah.
And then you took the master's.
I took a master's degree program. So New York Theological Seminary, which is a wonderful program, offers a master's degree program in professional studies called an MPS.
And but you took that because you wanted to impress the parole board.
I wanted to impress the parole board.
Okay.
I
the truth.
I'm telling the truth. I always tell it. I wanted to impress the parole board. I said, what better way than getting a master's degree? I applied for New York Theological Seminary. I was accepted, and they asked, you know, in that first, you know, why are you here? Me being the honest guy,
I'm
here because it's going to look good for the parole board. Let me tell you, and this is, you know, I always tell the truth, but 30 days into this program, it really didn't matter So I had a life on the back. It didn't matter if I got out, if I didn't get out. Thank God I got out, but it was like I found the purpose. I found what I want to do with the next part of my life. And that's what that program does for men, you know, that go through that program.
And we're going to talk about that in a second. Once again, we'd like to introduce you to Julio Mendina, Executive Director of Exodus Transitional Community in East Harlem, which helps ease the transition for former prison inmates back to society. It's not easy getting a job, but first you had to get through the parole officer. Tell us about that wonderful moment, the first time you went for parole.
Sure. So in New York State, you have something, in many states, you have something called the parole board. And in a parole board, you sit before three commissioners, you know, and those three commissioners basically decide your fate. They decide, are you going to stay or will you be released? So I go in front of this parole board, you know, master's degree in hand, ready to you know.
Ready to be an American.
Ready to be American. Ready to pay taxes, do all that stuff that we talk
about.
All
the good stuff.
Here you go. And they asked me, you know, why? Okay, so why should we let you out? And as I'm there, I'm talking, and I'm like, you know, I understand, you know, what I did in the past. That's not who I am any longer. I'm now looking to empower the communities. When I use that word empower, and this is verbatim, you know, quote, one of the commissioners says, whoa, 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 whoa. I don't want to hear none of that psycho babble bullshit about you and empowering the communities. You're a vulture. That's all you'll ever be, is a vulture. You prey on the innocent to the communities with your drug dealing. So don't ever tell me about how you're going to empower anything.
And then you walked out, and that was the end.
And that was that silence, and that was the end. And I knew I wasn't coming home, obviously.
Did you sort of want to grab the guy?
You know, they have all it's, you know, you don't hear that, how other people perceive you, right? I'm around loved ones. I'm around my family. I'm around people who love me. And here goes this other person who takes 2 minutes, reads something that's on paper about you, and says, this is who you are. And it does hurt. It does hurt. It does. You go back into a cell. You realize, you know, you get a decision that says, you know, you got to do 2 more years. You realize that, damn, is that who I am? You know, you do question that. Is that all they see me as worth? And you got to keep working. And this was what I did. I took those 2 years to keep working on myself. Because I think if we believe that, you know, the notion of this is all we are, will we ever be, is that worst moment in our lives, then what's the sense, right? We should never be let out of prison, right? I refuse to believe that that's all I will ever be is a vulture. And I remember that, to this day, and I think I use it as fuel. I think that's what God does. He allows me to use that as fuel to continue to do the work that we do now.
Once again, a reminder, you're listening to Conversations with Alan Walper on WBGO 88.3 FM and WBGO.org, and my guest is Julio Mendina, Executive Director of Exodus Transitional, an organization trying to help former prison inmates get a second chance. We want to talk about them, but it wasn't easy for you to get a second chance, right?
No, it wasn't.
You come out of prison?
I come out of prison. I go back. I live with moms. I haven't lived with mom since I was, you know, 15 years old. Love mama. But Ogden Avenue in the Bronx. And, you know, you look around. You start the job search. You know. You've been away for a while, so you're trying to convince employers that this is, you know, who you are, and you're looking for a job. But
you have friends saying, hey, Julio, come on back to the streets.
You got friends that,
what do they say?
Wow. It was amazing. They actually came. You know, I remember going to City Island and eating with some of the old guys. And, hey, how y'all doing? You know. And they were, hey, man, you know, are you ready? No, am I ready? You know, are you ready to come back? Or, you know, I remember one guy said, you know, wow, we've been waiting for you. And I'm like, no, you've been waiting no, I'm afraid. I don't do any of this no more, you know? And I remember one time, this one guy, we actually exchanged words, and he was so angry. And I remember he put his hands in my face. And, you know, that's a huge violation in our world, right? And, you know, you automatically gonna react to something, and I let it go. And I said, no, that's not, you know, this is the life I want to do. This is the life I want to try. We no longer 15 years old, man. And you know, the moment, Alan, what I saw in his eyes was, I get another chance. Julio gets another chance. He doesn't. Because he's been there. He's still in it. He's still entrenched in that. He's still worrying about who's going to kill him. He's still got bodyguards. He's still, I got another chance. And that's what I saw in his eyes. Why do you get it? And I don't.
And you now giving chances to lots of other people. You came out. You try to get a job. They thought your first name was Felon and not Julio.
You got it. Yeah.
And you spend some time, as we get to the end of this, I wish I could spend more time explaining how people kept telling you to come down for interviews and then they wouldn't give you the job until you got it. And you were there a while at a drug counseling place.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
And then came a magic day when you decided you were going to help everybody else in the world. And you formed?
I formed Exodus Transitional Community.
With a church?
With a church, Church of Living Hope. It's a nonprofit in East Harlem. It works with women and men being released from prison. We also work with kids on probation, 16 to 24 years old. We also now have sites in Poughkeepsie as well as Newburgh. We want to be where the quote-unquote action is. For us, we have about 20 people on staff, 18 that are formerly incarcerated.
One of them had been a murderer, Diana Ortiz.
Diana Ortiz has also transformed her life after serving 22 and a half years. She's my associate director, handles our actually was handling Poughkeepsie operations, and does a great job. And I think it's for us to tell the world that because we have a felony, don't dismiss us from the rest of the community. Don't dismiss us from society. Don't dismiss us from America, right? We want to be, we feel we have something to contribute. And it's important for us to have that contribution. And because that happened, and listen, we don't in no way excuse it. We understand that we're victims, and we are sorry constantly for the work that, for the damage that was done. But
how
we're just looking
make,
for another chance.
How will you make sure that your children don't fall for to the same problem that you had?
I think
you probably did it all the time.
I think that's it. And being a father, man. Being a father, the best father I can be, talking to them, man.
In 6 years old, 8 years
six
old?
Six and eight. My son is eight. Noah's eight. Julia's six. And they know they have a father who loves them, who cares about them, and they can talk to. And
do I they think know where your father is? Do they know where the father has come from?
And they know where the father's come from.
And what do they say?
They said, Dad, you really was in prison? And I'm like, yes, I was. And that was a time in my life, but that's not who I am. And that was it. When they asked a question, I answer it. I answer it as honestly as I can. And we go on to the next topic.
And it works.
And it works.
Should everybody be that truthful to their children? Or is it possible for people who come out of prison and deal with small kids? Are they able to do that? Because that's an exorcism that's really difficult.
Yeah, but I think it's important. I think it's important for us to become part of that family to make sure our children know, to make sure our family knows. Like this, listen, we are also experiencing some transitional things that we want to learn. We want your help. We want our children's help in doing this. And vice versa. We think we could be the parents that our children can look up to. It wasn't, again, we didn't lose our fatherhood or our motherhood because we went to prison. Okay. We did some horrible things to go to prison, but that doesn't take away our parental rights.
And your family is now proud of you for a different reason.
Yes, they are. They're proud of me for Exodus and the work that we're doing. And I think that's what makes it all worthwhile.
One last question. President George Bush, what was that like? You got about 20 seconds to tell me.
President George Bush, I'm going to tell you this quick story. I'm at the White House with him. I'm in the Oval Office, believe it or not. He tells me, Julio, I really believe in second chances. I'm like, yeah, whatever. He's like, Julio, listen, I was an alcoholic. I know what it is to have a second chance. That's a true story that came from the president to me. So I'm always amazed at why would he tell me that? Have no idea. But it just talks about second chances and how important they are.
Well, you've had a second chance. You've done very well with it.
Thank you, Al.
Julio Medina, thank you for sharing your life with us and telling us about your passion for finding a way to give former prison inmates a second chance at becoming a functional American, a functional member of American society. And now a word about the off-camera people who contribute so much to our program. Joanna Walper is the senior producer, and Doug Doyle is our executive producer. Conrad Saguinetti is our engineer. Dana Damiani and Michael Mungiello are production associates for this episode. If you want to listen to Julio Medina's story again, you can hear it all over by clicking Conversations with Alan Walper or subscribe for free on iTunes. Join us again next Tuesday night at 7:30 for an interview with another person whose life and ideas are on the cutting edge. I'm Alan Walper.
Special thanks to Phantom Audio, a full-service production studio in New York's Flatiron District. And support for Conversations with Alan Wolper has been provided by the Blanche and Irving Laurie Foundation.